This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Everywhere you look these days, you see Russia.
Well, good afternoon. Today, a grand jury in the District of Columbia returned an indictment presented by the Special Counsel's Office. The indictment charges 12 Russian military officers by name for conspiring to interfere with the 2016 presidential election.
2018 World Cup kicking off today in Moscow. The month-long
White House today confirmed that President Trump will be speaking one-on-one with Russian President Vladimir Putin during their July 16th summit in Finland.
The British Home Secretary is calling on Russia to come clean after another case of the nerve agent Novichok was detected in the south of England.
Today, a team of Republican senators were in Moscow meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
This is not to mention Trump's thumbs up to the annexation of Crimea because the citizens speak Russian. This is not to mention mounting fear in Estonia about being the next Russian annex. But what if Russia isn't just everywhere you look, but also everywhere you don't look? And what if it isn't just these days, but the last three decades? What if when the president said, "I have nothing to do with Russia," he actually meant, "I've been accepting their patronage since 1987 and am the Manchurian candidate, only with more financial crimes and illicit sex."
BuzzFeed published a dossier of alleged Russian dirt on Donald Trump and his campaign.
That dossier alleged that Russians had a so-called pee tape of prostitutes that Trump had paid to urinate on each other and his bed in a Russian hotel suite.
It's terrifying, also titillating. So much so that activist writer Glenn Greenwald this week excoriated the government and the media for what he sees as anti-Russia hysteria on par with McCarthyism. This is what he said to Putin mouthpiece RT Television while he himself was in Moscow.
Any kind of connection with or interaction with Russia is viewed as inherently suspicious or even worse, and it's extremely dangerous and extremely toxic, and it's one of the reasons why I decided to come here, because I think it's very important to combat that attitude.
But just when you think that maybe you have been caught up in a conspiratorial hysteria, along comes a New York Magazine piece by Jonathan Chait, who assembles a large number of documented entanglements between Trump and the Kremlin, to imagine, as a thought experiment, a president utterly compromised by Russian intelligence and working overtime to destabilize the Western alliance.
Chait lays out what could be considered the worst-case scenario for Trump-Russia collusion, that Donald Trump has been a Russian intelligence asset since 1987.
So which is it? As a citizen and a media consumer, do you tamp down your imagination along Greenwald lines or go full John le Carré along Chait's? For this, we consult Tom Nichols, a professor at the U.S. Naval War College and expert on national security matters related to Russia. He addressed the Chait scenario this week in Politico.
What Chait points out is that Trump has a long, very deep, varied set of contacts with the Russians. And people who are critical of the Chait piece want to strawman that into a kind of red president, you know, episode of the Americans. And that's not how anything in the real world works. It's more useful to think of Donald Trump or any prominent American not as an agent or an asset doing the bidding of Moscow, but rather as an investment.
And how historically does Russian intelligence invest?
Entangle them in deals and favors and contracts and make it all seem very normal, and that you're among friends, that you're not really being asked to do anything untoward. And then as you get deeper, then you start doing favors, perhaps doing things that might not be totally above board. And over time, you find that you've been kind of trapped in this spider web without even realizing it. And then by the time you do realize it, you're in so deep. You don't need direction. You start to anticipate the needs of the people that you've been relying on for years and years and years.
Now, the temptation is to dismiss that scenario because it supposes that somehow the Russian intelligence services knew in 1987 that this guy was potentially going to be the president of the United States, and if they just invest carefully, why, they can help make that come to pass. But the Russians do this right to a lot of people.
Right. When they started to invest in Donald Trump, the man, he was a junk stock. He was a cheap investment. Now he's a blue chip. The Russians invest in a lot of people. Some of it pays off, some of it never pays off. We really have to get away from this notion that somehow the Russians groomed him to be president.
Based on your understanding of how Moscow develops sources, how does Trump as a personality fit into the picture?
The president as a man, especially as a younger man, was pretty much a menu of recruitable weaknesses. Money trouble, zipper trouble, vanity, ego. I and many others have pointed out that if the Russian intelligence services hadn't been interested in a wealthy New Yorker with Donald Trump's personality characteristics back in the 1980s and 90s, they would have been guilty of malpractice.
Tell me, please, what we should be looking at that really raises the possibility that Trump's entanglements with Russia could truly be evidence of compromise.
There's several things to look at once you brush away all of the kind of kooky conspiracy stuff. The very first is that after he comes back from the Soviet Union in the 80s, he decides that he needs to start advising Ronald Reagan about what to do about nuclear arms control. He cannonballs right into national debate with a full-page ad in the New York Times, which is pretty weird behavior. After that, I think the most interesting things about Trump's relationship with the Russians are things that a forensic accountant would really want to look at. You know, who's buying these buildings? This is a long history of Russian money flowing through the Trump Organization. Then getting deeper and deeper into the shadowy world of the oligarchs and the millionaires and the people wanting to buy real estate in places like New York. And there is no way that you can innocently deal with that level of money and power in Russia and not be dealing with the Russian state and the Russian intelligence community, because they are all part of the same world. And then when we get closer to the campaign, then things start getting really kind of freaky with the hiring of people like Paul Manafort and some of the other things that happened during the campaign.
Manafort, who was a hired gun for all sorts of despots and evil regimes around the world, and was paid on the order of $10 million to help a Russian-friendly Ukrainian political leader.
And by definition, a Putin-friendly political leader. Manafort has logged a lot of frequent flyer miles back and forth to Ukraine, trying to keep Putin's crony in power. I mean, look, it's not illegal to be a lobbyist for bad people in the world, and it's not even uncommon in Washington. But for someone with those kinds of contacts to the Kremlin that are, you know, barely one step removed by working with Ukraine, to suddenly be in charge of the presidential candidacy and campaign of a major party candidate, that's the part where if you put it in a movie script, they would send it back to you as just too fantastic and silly.
It makes me wonder if, considering Donald Trump's personality, considering the Russians' needs, and considering his eagerness to oppose those who oppose him, you wouldn't need any extortion. You wouldn't need any P tape. You wouldn't need any money laundering and extortion material. All you have to do is realize that by just manipulating his personality and playing to his ego, he will serve your needs without you even asking him to do so.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think if you want to leave the Russians out of it for a moment, I think that's exactly what the North Koreans just did. The North Koreans just took the president for a complete ride based on his ego and his interest in having a big splashy television event of a summit that he has clearly, now that he's gotten what he wanted and the North Koreans have gotten what they wanted, the president's no longer interested. He has very short attention span about this stuff. So I think that's a good point, that this notion that you have to have these, you know, tough as nails people in, you know, disguises walking around New York warning Trump about what to do is just silly. It's just nonsense.
All right, I want to end this conversation where it began, and that is to talk about the dangers of trading in conspiracy theories. Why is this conversation not something that could have been plucked from the archives of Glenn Beck? It's pretty out there.
Well, in terms of how the Russians, or again, any foreign intelligence service compromises human beings, it's not out there. This is normal. This happens every day to people around the world, whether they're in business or the military or diplomacy, whoever. This is just how it's done. So it's not really out there. The part that's out there is the Russians created this guy almost like in a, you know, hydroponic spy tank to take down the Americans 30 years down the line. That's just ridiculous. And it leads to all of these fantasies about how the Russians hijacked our election and they put this guy in there. You know, if you don't like the fact that Donald Trump is president, then you need to turn to your fellow voters and to engage them about it. The Russians obviously had a preference. They bombarded us with a lot of propaganda. They clearly tried to interfere in our election the way they do with information warfare. But this was not some, you know, 30-year plan to create a red president. The actual world that we're talking about here is much more mundane. It's much more boring. It's far less glamorous. I think if people approach it with that much more realistic kind of view, they'll understand this.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tom Nichols is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College and author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge, and Why It Matters. Coming up, what if great investigative journalism falls in the forest and doesn't make a noise? 15 years later, it becomes a movie. This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. If making sense of Russian interference and computer hacking and conflicting media narratives is a challenge for news consumers, it can be positively dangerous for a journalist trying to uncover the truth. Marcy Wheeler blogs about national security and civil liberties at EmptyWheel.net, and her sources include some sinister actors, among them hackers and other dark web sorts. As she was reporting on the 2016 presidential election, particularly the hacks of the DNC and other entities, she came to believe that one of her sources was not only deceiving her about key elements of Russian interference, he was an active player in that operation and a threat to her own safety. So, in an act that defies the norms of journalistic practice, Wheeler outed her source to the FBI. Marcy, welcome back to OTM.
Always great to be on.
All right. You dimed out a source to the FBI. That wasn't surprising only because of your career built on being suspicious of the government, but just journalistically. News organizations very seldom do these things, lest we be perceived as agents of or collaborators with the state. Why you? Why now?
Because the person was doing ongoing significant damage to innocent people, and I wasn't willing to sit there and watch that continue to happen. The other thing is that I do think he was trying to tamper with my site, but also because if the FBI otherwise came to certain information that was in my possession, I believed that they would start tracking my readers to try and find him And so I wanted to prevent that from happening. So there were a bunch of different ethical concerns that wouldn't necessarily be the same ones for somebody working at New York Times, for example. But I will also say that the security challenge of even getting to the FBI took me a very long time and a lot of hoop jumping.
Well, were you a walk-in? I mean, they got a building right here in Washington, D.C.
Among the rules that I broke, don't talk to the FBI, don't let the police in your house without a warrant. One rule I did not break was don't talk to the FBI without a lawyer. So first I had to find a lawyer who didn't think this was a crazy story and who was willing to make at least some concessions for ways I was trying to protect sources and other journalists and so on. So I had privileged conversations with 8 different lawyers before I got to the FBI.
The source that you turned in has been someone who's been giving you information for some good while. What happened that you became suspicious not only of what he was telling you, but of perhaps a role in collusion with the Russians?
It was a lot of little tiny details that built up over time. For a long period of time, I would go on a day-to-day basis, one point believing that I was correct and the next point believing I was stark raving insane. But it was information that started in June of 2016 that was suspicious. But of course, there was no way I was going to go to the FBI because journalists don't do that. And then there was an interim period where I was like, I'll just ask questions of the FBI. But I didn't find a way to do that securely. And then as time went on, I grew increasingly alarmed and the damage that he was doing was increasingly obvious.
And I just want to get clear of what that damage might have been.
There was clear disinformation, clear deception about who he was, but that's separate from the actual physical damage, real damage he was doing in the real world, the role he played in the election year attack. And I'm going to stay a little bit vague about what that is still, because it's not out there yet.
This is a kind of complicated interview to conduct because you can't give me any of the details that I crave and make sense of what has taken place.
I mean,
here,
look, the election year attack involved hacks. So I will say that he was involved in election year hacks. And I'll leave it there.
On behalf of the Russians, perhaps in the Democratic National Committee, perhaps in WikiLeaks, perhaps elsewhere.
Yeah, and there were more hacks than people, I think, understand as part of the election year attack.
Now, this person, this mystery source, he is not someone who is part of the administration, not someone who was, as far as you knew, part of the campaign, but who has been an ongoing source for you on national security and law enforcement matters over time. Nonetheless, just a few hours after the polls closed in November of 2016, you heard from him in a text message that gave you some remarkably inside information about the new administration's plans, in fact, its actions. Can you tell me about that text?
I got it about 14 hours after the polls closed in Hawaii. And the substance of it basically said that Mike Flynn would be contacting, quote, Team Al-Assad within the next 48 hours, meaning that he was going to do some outreach to whatever Team Al-Assad means, whether that actually means the Syrians or the Russians, and that he had been instructed to do so immediately after the election.
And you're thinking, I guess, well, that's weird. How would he have any idea what the new administration is planning? But apart from that, you weren't all that suspicious at the time?
I didn't really start trying to figure out what the text was about until months later, after I had become more convinced that he had had a role in the election year attack.
All right, I want to get back to journalistic best practices.
Or not.
even if you had had an explicit off-the-record arrangement with this guy, which evidently you didn't, under journalistic canon, being lied to would void any anonymity deal. So you could have simply written a story naming your source and about the nature of his lies, disinformation, and so forth, and just let justice or the Justice Department take its natural course. But you didn't do that. Why?
Several reasons. One of which is I believed that that would allow him to flee. It would have meant that law enforcement would not have been able to pursue him. But the other reason is that some of what he was doing was so reactive and dangerous that I believed that he might respond by doing far worse damage than he was already doing. So I believed that that might exacerbate the problem rather than fix it.
In the days since you've written this, have you gotten any backlash from people you depend on who are afraid that they're going to be the next name handed to the FBI?
Well, covering what I cover, I rely on criminals as sources as much as I rely on law enforcement. Of some of my criminal sources, one definitely really questions what I did. Another one doesn't seem to. I will take a hit for this. I absolutely acknowledge that and know that and expect that. I think it was worth it. I think the information I had was important enough that the hit I will take is just a cost that I'm willing to pay, I guess.
You believe that this guy has been a source not just for you, but for many, many other news organizations, which raises the possibility that we as news consumers have been disinformed about significant aspects of the probe. Do you believe that the narrative that people have pieced together through other reporting has skewed our perceptions?
With one very notable exception, I don't know that his disinformation has had a big role on the reporting of the investigation. And I think that his disinformation, in some cases, successfully underplayed the role that Russia had in hacking going back a couple of years. But of course, journalists are generally not going to single source stuff. And therefore, I know of a number of stories that he tried to place that did not succeed or did not succeed directly from him. But I can think back going years of what I now, in retrospect, believe was an attempt at disinformation to hide what Russia was up to.
What is the biggest takeaway that our listeners should take away?
That the stakes are real. This investigation is real. It is based off of, at least as far as I'm concerned, some pretty startling information. And that the notion of the underlying threat, both in the election year attacks and the threats going forward, those are all real. So while we get caught up in the partisanship and the suggestions this is just Republicans versus Democrats, people need to stop thinking in those terms and think in terms of the damage that's been done to the United States and, frankly, to innocent people around the world.
Marcy Wheeler blogs about national security at EmptyWheel.net. Be safe, and thank you very much.
Thanks.
A web of deception from a modern White House? It's horrifying, but it sure isn't new. Lyndon Johnson and the Gulf of Tonkin, Nixon and Watergate, Clinton and Monica Gate. Then there was the George W. Bush administration, when a tissue of lies about supposed weapons of mass destruction triggered the invasion of Iraq at a cost of roughly $1 trillion and many hundreds of thousands of human lives, and ongoing deadly chaos in the region. The Rob Reiner film Shock and Awe revisits the run-up to the war, with its trumped-up intelligence and a credulous mass media that mainly failed to challenge the Bush administration's motives, its competence, and its phony evidence of an Iraqi threat.
Hussein has vowed revenge. He has anthrax. He loves biological weapons. He has terrorist training camps, including 707, to practice on.
One person close to the debate said to me this week that it's no longer a question of if, it's a question of how we go after Saddam Hussein.
George Bush is the president. He makes the decisions. And, you know, it's just one American. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where.
The movie focuses on the reporting of Jonathan Landay and Warren Strobel, formerly of the Knight Ridder News Service, who refused to defer to the government's narrative and unraveled the fraud.
Tell your boss we're going to run her whether he comments or not. Actually, yes, it is a matter of life and death. We're talking about going to f***ing war.
Think of All the President's Men with the added element of the heroes working in an environment of colossal journalistic failure. Jonathan Landay is now a national security correspondent for Reuters and is played in the film by Woody Harrelson. Jonathan, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
You and Strobel had asked the right questions. You'd put it all together, the fabricated intelligence, the leaks from Dick Cheney's office. But you were voices in the wilderness. Why?
It's a good question, and it's one we get asked all the time. I think there are several reasons. We're talking about a time immediately post 9/11. There was a propensity on the part of the public and the media to stand behind the president at a time of a national catastrophe.
And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
I think that was a problem. As part of that, there is a problem that still exists today that we refer to as access journalism. And some reporters are loath, or at least back then were loath, to challenge the administration's line on Iraq and Saddam and collaboration between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, bin Laden, etc., at the risk of losing their sources. Perhaps sheer laziness on the part of many reporters back then. I think that was also a problem.
You were advantaged by working merely for the Knight Ridder News Service.
We're not ABC, we're not CBS, we're not Fox, we're not CNN. We're not the New York Times, we're not the Washington Post. If every other news organization wants to be stenographers for the Bush administration, let them.
You weren't the New York Times, and as a consequence, you were forced to move down the food chain where you actually found information.
We had some fairly highly placed sources, but two of the other main characters in this movie are my boss, John Walcott, and my former colleague, Joe Galloway, who was a co-author of We Were Soldiers Once and Young. And Joe had a rule, which is one that I follow too, because I spend a lot of time as a war correspondent. And that is, I want to talk to the sergeants, to the grunts, to find out really what the impact of decisions made in Washington had on their lives, the wars that they were fighting. And so, yes, that was a key reason for our ability back then to get the story right.
We don't much see the villains. And I don't mean Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, but the mainstream press, chiefly the New York Times.
Honey, I think someone's stealing our New York Times.
I canceled it.
Why would you do that?
It's propaganda.
I need that for my work.
Packaging press releases from the White House, the State Department, and the Pentagon. Sorry, that's not a real newspaper.
Chiefly Judith Miller at the New York Times, who was suckered into not only passing along the administration's lies, but being cited by the administration as supposed independent verification of its bogus WMD claims. Is that the true villain?
It wasn't just the New York Times. It was major newspapers. It was the networks. They all basically acted as stenographers for the administration, never questioning the claim that Saddam Hussein had never gotten rid of his weapons of mass destruction programs and was in league with this extreme Islamist terrorist group based in Afghanistan.
A former top Iraqi nuclear scientist tells Congress Iraq could build 3 nuclear bombs by 2005.
Weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein, plus his known contact with terrorists, including al-Qaeda terrorists, is simply a threat too large to continue to tolerate.
And that, I believe, was the reason why public support for the invasion rose to the level that it did. And throughout the film, and in particular, there's one scene where one of my stories, which I wrote 3 days before a consequential Judith Miller story on the so-called aluminum tubes, that begins a series of comparisons between what we were writing and what was appearing in the mainstream press. I had written a story about how senior U.S. diplomatic, military, and intelligence officials had seen no appreciable increase in the threat presented by Saddam Hussein to U.S. national security in the region. 3 days later, you had the aluminum tube story appear. It was a Sunday in the New York Times. The United States had intercepted some of these aluminum tubes that were bound for Iraq that the administration, through the New York Times, said were going to be used for devices known as centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium to the point where it can be used as nuclear weapons fuel.
And then that very Sunday, Vice President Dick Cheney went on the morning shows citing the New York Times story, which his people had leaked, as supposed independent verification of Saddam's WMDs.
There's a story in the New York Times this morning. This is, and I want to attribute to the Times, I don't want to talk about, obviously, specific intelligence sources, but it's now public that, in fact, he has been seeking to acquire, and we have been able to intercept and prevent him from acquiring through this particular channel, the kinds of tubes that are necessary to build a centrifuge.
Those two stories were diametrically opposed. And there's a scene in the movie where I say, Woody Harrelson, acting as me, says we both can't be right.
Over the past 14 months, Iraq has tried to buy thousands of specially designed aluminum tubes, which American officials believe were intended as components of centrifuges to enrich uranium.
Well, one thing's for sure.
What's that?
We can't both be right.
And that sets off some scenes where reporting by the mainstream media is set off against some of the stuff that we were doing, which was diametrically opposed.
There was one moment that certainly resonated with me. It's a scene with you and your then wife, who was from the former Yugoslavia.
And they are really pushing this nationalism thing at school.
Oh, what do you expect? Of course there's going to be patriotism now.
Oh, you want to call it patriotism? Fine. It smells a lot like nationalism to me. That's how it started in Yugoslavia before the war. It tore my country apart.
You know, I heard exactly the same sentiment at exactly the same time from my Serbian wife, who warned me about Milosevic-type nationalism and all that comes with it. And lo and behold.
My ex-wife was my translator in former Yugoslavia. I covered all of the wars there. She also worked for Human Rights Watch as their person on the ground, risking her life, and was just absolutely astounded at the way that history and ethnic tensions were manipulated, not just by Mr. Milosevic, but by the late Franjo Tuđman, who was the president of Croatia, and other leading nationalists on all sides, to the point where, you know, when she saw all the flags going up, she put a UN flag on the front of our house.
I want to finish up by going back to the movies. I talked about All the President's Men, Woodward and Bernstein. You know, I think Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman changed the lives of two reporters who so significantly had an impact on history. But theirs was a story about journalistic triumph. And your story, as dramatized in Shock and Awe, is mainly about failure. Not yours, but journalism's writ large. When you were approached by Rob Reiner and you talked about turning this experience into a movie, did anyone mention that as storytelling goes, it's just a total bummer?
No, I don't think so. What I think this movie does is celebrate investigative journalism and shows the American public how we do our job, how we set about holding government accountable and reporting the truth. Let's not forget that in the end, even though there was an invasion our stories turned out to be accurate. One of the most interesting things is that a reporting was never questioned from Washington, D.C. No one ever from the Bush administration denounced what we were doing as inaccurate, because that would have been the best advertising we could have asked for our work. We are still seeing the consequences of paying the price for that decision. But I hope that people will see the movie as a celebration of responsible investigative journalism.
Well, Jonathan, congratulations and thanks very much.
And thank you.
Jonathan Landay is a national security correspondent for Reuters. The film Shock and Awe is out in theaters this month. Coming up, standing up to an authoritarian demagogue and losing. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. After 9/11, Jonathan Landay's wife shuddered at the flag-waving, the overreach on national security methods, and the blind fealty to a president, because she had seen it all before, in the Balkans, where Serbia's Slobodan Milosevic and Croatia's Franjo Tudjman whipped their populations into a nationalist frenzy, and thereupon into a catastrophic war.
Croatian propaganda echoing over the front line in Mostar, the most vicious theater of war in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
The Bosnian Serbs again shelling the supposedly safe areas of Bihać, Srebrenica, Goražde, and Sarajevo. The Bosnian capital is again a city under siege, running out of food and water.
Of course, in the early 90s in the former Yugoslavia, there were, like Landay and Strobel, also lonely voices of dissent from the popular narrative. One such was Srbijanka Turajlić, an academic and political dissident who spoke out against Milosevic at grave professional and personal risk to herself, and whom to this day is a democratic activist in a country that is more authoritarian than its democratic trappings would suggest. Turajlić is also the subject of a recent film, The Other Side of Everything, by her daughter, the documentarian Mila Turajlić. The title refers to political discourse, but it also refers to something very literal, a door in the Turajlić family apartment that had remained locked for 70 years.
Right after the Second World War, one thing that happened in most communist countries is that there was this feeling that everything needs to be equalized, and particularly after the destruction of the war, housing became a big problem. And so big apartments, let's call them bourgeois apartments, were divided up and other families were forcibly moved in to live in them. And so in our case, the doors in our living room were locked and three other families were moved into various rooms in the apartment, which wasn't that unusual at the time. But what was unusual is that by 2000, 2010, 2015, we were still living like that. And I grew up thinking that was the status quo. You know, I didn't grow up thinking there was something unusual about the fact that there were doors in our living room and you could hear people on the other side, but I'd never been there. But my mom never presented it to us as something that was rightfully ours. I think there was more of this feeling, you know, we're kind of living through grand waves of history and they're shaping our private lives in our private space, but that's just how things are in many ways. And there was definitely never any idea that those doors could one day open.
In the 80s, Tito died, the wall fell, and Yugoslavia turned its destiny very quickly over to Milosevic, himself a former communist apparatchik, but one who quickly discarded that orthodoxy and seized on age-old ethnic rivalries that had mainly been suppressed by Tito. And your mother saw it coming?
The war was starting. Her students were being drafted into the army. Many were deserting the country for that reason. And she became incredibly active in helping them organize rallies and meetings and so on, and trying to get the University of Belgrade to boycott a lot of what was going on politically. And she ended up getting fired from the university for it, you know, down the road. But the country was closed off. There were sanctions. And so it was just this feeling of, you know, someone has to try and resist.
And the resistance was not only in the face of the government, but of large swaths of the population who deemed dissidents against Milosevic and his supporting parties as unpatriotic, as treasonous, as anti-Serb.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I see so many parallels when I look at what's happening in many countries in Europe today. You know, when patriotism starts being bandied around as a word, and you begin to see this incredible divisiveness in public discourse, you know, two sides who can no longer hear each other or are willing to speak to each other. And then from that point on, everything kind of starts taking on hysterical proportions. And while we remained so staunchly divided into these two separate trenches and are not able to communicate in any way, society feels like it's really broken down.
And there was your mom on stage, surrounded by tens of thousands of protesters and thousands of security forces of military might, and not knowing that she was safe. You were a kid at the time. How did you process all of that?
For a very long time, for my entire childhood, I followed her to all of these meetings and demonstrations, and I thought it was the most normal thing in the world that, yeah, you know, my mom's out on the street and she's holding these speeches, and it didn't occur to me until much later that I didn't know anybody else's mother who had done quite the same thing. And so I think it's only when I started making this film, you know, I reached my mid-30s and I began to realize that I was reaching the age my mom had been when everything had begun. And I began to realize that each one of us essentially arrives at a moment in our life when we have to face ourselves and this decision of, am I going to take active responsibility for the society I'm living in, or am I going to walk away from that? And I think it's only really when I reach the age where I have to make that choice that I began to look at what my mother did with a completely different appreciation.
Very near the beginning of the film, we see an award ceremony, and Srbijanka is the guest of honor. The award was for her decades of courage and speaking truth to power. She had a very memorable response to the honor. She says, "This is absolutely the first time that I receive an award for total failure." Well, it's true. Tito was a dictator to his death. Milosevic was an autocratic demagogue who fomented genocide. The democratic successors to the rubble of ex-Yugoslavia were fractious and corrupt. And the new leader of Serbia, the Western-facing Aleksandar Vučić, has his own ultra-nationalist history and himself effectively controls all Serbian institutions, including the not really free media. Did Srbijanka fail?
We all failed. That's the tragedy of it. So I was 21 when we had what we call our revolution, which is the day that Milosevic fell from power and you could say the democratic chapter of Serbia began. And it wasn't until then that I realized that the 10 years that we had spent on the streets protesting against him hadn't actually prepared us for what happens when you get the possibility to build. And no one of my mother's generation who had been, you know, among the leaders of the protests, the politicians and the intellectuals, had actually any kind of road plan of what happens next. We had all united against Milosevic, but that didn't necessarily mean that we all shared the vision of the country that we wanted to build. And so for people of my generation who were in their 20s, that moment, which should have been the kind of, you know, ecstatic highlight of our political engagement and definitely the kind of end of the beginning, let's say, was actually the opposite. Most of us left politics incredibly, incredibly disillusioned with the realities of what it means to try and build a democracy. And in 2013, I was in Egypt, in Cairo, to present one of my films. And I ended up going to Tahrir Square on the weekend of their first presidential elections after the revolution. And I found myself standing there surrounded by all of these young Egyptians who were absolutely euphoric in this kind of taste of freedom and their country was about to transform. And I found myself looking at them as if I was 50 years older than them. I was looking at them thinking, you guys have absolutely no idea that this is the high point of your life and that everything from here is just going to be one giant, giant downward slide of disappointment and disillusionment. And that's kind of the ultimate tragedy because my generation isn't actually willing to take on the responsibilities of building Serbia because we've been so disillusioned by what democracy has brought.
Most of the movie is conversations between you and your mom. We don't see you, but we do see her. And throughout these interviews, Srbijanka is smoking like a chimney, for 90 minutes and apparently for a whole lifetime. And, you know, I'm sitting there in the audience wondering, how is this woman even alive? But that question applies equally to the politics of it. I mean, Tito jailed and killed people. Milosevic is presumed to have killed several opposition voices. How, through all that took place in that society, has Srbijanka survived?
You know, I never felt that the danger was so immediate. It was just this feeling of, do you stay in your home country and try and fight for a better society, or do you run away and escape? She always said to us, you know, if we leave, we've left our country to them. And so that was not an option. And what makes this the heart of this film, or these conversations as you describe them, is that I'm essentially trying to get to the bottom of that choice, of trying to understand, does she today regret that choice? Does she feel that all of this activism and engagement and speeches were worthwhile, that they actually made a difference? Because from my perspective, as you said, we've all failed, they've all failed. And the conversation actually ends up taking us to a very, very intimate place, you know? And she turns the tables on me because towards the end of the film, she looks at me and she says, okay, now I'm too old and someone from your generation is going to have to speak up. And there's this real moment where she kind of stares us down saying, and who's going to speak up now?
And you got the hell out of there at the first opportunity. Was it difficult to confront that question?
Very. And it's still, I mean, I'm kind of still with one foot in Serbia and one foot outside, and it's a question I still haven't really been able to answer.
Well, back to that door, that magical metaphor, that portal to the story of your family and of Yugoslavia itself. At the end of the movie, that door is finally opened. What were the circumstances and what was revealed?
When I started making the film, I never dreamt that that could happen because it wasn't possible at the time. What happened in the meantime is in the 5 years that it took me to make the film, I became friendly, let's say, with the last remaining person who was living on the other side. And what happens, to try not to give away too much, is our invisible neighbor dies during the film. And at the same time, a process of restitution of property begins in Serbia. Kind of in some strange, I think, unsatisfactory way, trying to right the wrongs of the past via passing of laws, you know, as if history could be righted by now introducing new laws. And my mother and I have a very complex discussion about that in the film, but in the end, ultimately, with very divided feelings, there is a moment in which we open the door. And I think if anything does happen with that moment, is that you begin to feel that a common ground is possible. At least that's what I was trying to do in this film. You know, I grew up in a country that was so deeply divided and remains to this day so deeply divided. And I kind of feel that as a filmmaker, if there's something that could define as my responsibility, it is trying to find a space in which we can communicate.
One more thing, Mila. There is another scene in your film where Srbijanka describes bristling at having to fill out the official census.
Ne izjašnjavam se.
Imate pravo. Materni jezik.
Materni jezik mi je srpski.
The census agent asks her what her nationality is, and Srbijanka replies, I elect not to declare it. That's your right, he says. Neither in her apartment nor in her demographics, she does not want to be subdivided.
I knew the census would happen during the time of the shooting because, like here in the U.S., it happens every 10 years in Serbia. And I knew I wanted to film it because it comes with these politically charged questions, which are, you know, what is your ethnicity? What is your religion? And what I thought was so important is that you see how necessary it is for all of us to reject being easily labeled and categorized politically, to indicate with this film that all of our identities are much more rich and much more complex than, you know, this idea that we can be grouped and labeled and neatly filed under categories that can then really easily be manipulated in the media.
Well, just as you alluded to earlier, that idea inevitably reminds me of the identity politics of 2018 America. And as you mentioned, most of Europe, of us against them, of grievance politics. In Yugoslavia, this led to civil war. If you were to channel your mother now and sound a warning, at the risk of belaboring the obvious, what would that be?
When we did this tour in the U.S. a few months back, I began to realize that in the way that I tried to tell the story of Yugoslavia, that people see it as a warning story. This is what happens if you don't pay attention. This is what happens if you think what's going on politically doesn't concern you. This is what happens if you think war could never happen in my country. We're far too civilized. You know, it happens in some faraway places, but it doesn't happen here. Civil war couldn't happen here. And what I was trying to show in this film was that there was always a voice of reason, but then most times it went unheard. And if I was trying to do anything with the film or some kind of warning was to say, you know, pay attention, listen, and most importantly, I think really, really try to open a space for a conversation.
Mila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Documentarian Mila Turaljic is the author of The Other Side of Everything, a documentary about her mother, Serbianka, that will open in New York this July. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Kate Brown, Yasmin Khan, and Meg Harney, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Merritt Jacob. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.